Several years ago, when I was first beginning to read serious biblical scholarship, I came across a book on the Gospel of Mark called Binding the Strong Man. It contains not only a radical reading of Mark that has forever changed how I view that gospel, but the book also showed me a way of reading scripture that was creative and yet careful, scholarly and yet socially engaged. In short, it was a way of reading the scriptures that brought home the power of the good news, not only for then, but for now. The author of that book, of course, was Ted Myers. And he is not your typical biblical scholar. He doesn't work from the context of a university. He is actively engaged in a range of social justice work. He lives his life into the kind of Sabbath economics that he's written about in his books, including one by that title. He's a teacher, both by writing books, but also by speaking at a large number of gatherings and conferences like this. And he is the author of numerous books, a couple of which I've mentioned, and also Who Will Roll Away the Stone. His books, by the way, are outside by the Englewood Review of Books table. There are several Ted's books available for sale. He is also the founder of Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries, which he describes as an ecumenical experiment in discipleship, collaborative works of healing, justice, nonviolence, and mutual aid. When we first heard that Ted Myers turned his attention in a critical way to ecological issues, particularly a vision for the church as embracing watershed discipleship, we were thrilled, and our planning committee quickly decided that Chad would be a person that we would want to have with us. It's been a long time coming for Ted Myers to be here at the Ecclesia Project with us, so we're glad to have you with us and look forward to your message.
Lost some great elders in our church and in our movement. just a couple months ago. Dr. Vincent Harding passed on into the cloud of witnesses, great teacher of all of us, the foremost historian, civil rights movement, greatest social movement in the history of this country, and in many ways, a great keeper of the story. Big loss to all of us. Also, in the previous year, Gordon Cosby passed away at age 95, the founder of one of the oldest alternative church experiments in the United States, Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. Gordon Cosby was a pastor and a prophet in the Imperial City and had global influence even though he never left his neighborhood. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that all of us in this room are the children of Gordon Cosby and Vincent Harding, whether we know it or not. We're here because they did their work faithfully. So I want to call on them and ask them to pray for us. I also want to acknowledge, as Mark did this morning, that we are yet again in a world in which bombs are flying. 83 people killed in the last few days in Gaza, including 21 children. Lord, have mercy. Anna Jane, are you somewhere? There's Anna Jane. Let's give her a hand for fine work. I want to come back to what we saw last night in a second, but just to get oriented. So let's see. Norm got creation, and Philip this afternoon gets redemption. That leaves me with, sin and the fall. Super. But in fact, Anna Jane and that great Showtime episode last night already began the very difficult work of getting us yet again to face some inconvenient truths. And one of the questions really coming out of that work, Anna Jane, and indeed, in a lot of the table talk yesterday, is how do we go about telling these truths to ourselves and to our communities and to our industries, to our country. So I want to talk about the apocalypse of the Anthropocene. And this piece here is a working draft. It's my attempt to answer the question, how do we tell this story? I don't think this is going to change your dad's mind, okay, this approach, but I do hope that it resonates with some of you here in this venerable gathering that's been going on for apparently too many years to count. I want to begin in a little bit of a counterintuitive way, and I like to use PowerPoint just to help visual learners see some images and some texts. And this isn't a kind of a full-fledged thing, but there are a few texts and images I wanted you to see. I think it helps. I want to begin with, of all people, Kurt Vonnegut. This poem is, as far as I can tell, the last thing he published before his death in 2007. It's entitled Requiem. The crucified planet Earth, should it find a voice and a sense of irony, might now well say of our abuse of it, "Forgive them, Father. They know not what they do." The irony is that we know exactly what we're doing. When the last living thing has died on account of us, how poetical it would be if Earth could say in a voice floating up perhaps from the floor of the Grand Canyon, "It is finished. People did not like it." There are a couple of aspects of this dark meditation on our ecological Golgotha that I wish to reflect on by way of framing comments this morning. first the notion of the earth crucified. A couple of years ago, Paul Kingsnorth, one of the most thoughtful British environmental analysts, wrote the following. Sitting on the desk in front of me are a set of graphs. The horizontal axis of each graph is identical. It represents time from the years 1750 to 2000. The graphs show variously human population levels, CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, exploitation of fisheries, destruction of tropical forests, paper consumption, number of motor vehicles, water use, rate of species extinction, totality of the gross domestic product of the human economy. What grips me about these graphs, and graphs don't usually grip me, is that although they show very different indices, they all have an almost identical shape. A line begins on the left of the page, rising gradually as it moves to the right. And then in the last inch or so, around the year 1950, it suddenly veers steeply upward like a pilot banking sharply before a mountain suddenly appearing. The root cause of all of these trends is the same, a rapacious human economy that is bringing the world swiftly to the brink of chaos. We know this. Some of us even attempt to stop it happening. And yet all of these trends continue to get rapidly worse, and there is no sign of that changing soon. So I think this is one way of crystallizing concisely the meaning of our historical moment and the essential rationale for the proposal that I want to work with you on this morning. Let each of us in the Ecclesia Project be very, very clear that the deep and broad ecological crisis that has been stalking our history for centuries has now arrived in the interlocking catastrophes of climate destruction, habitat degradation, species extinction, resource exhaustion, so-called peak everything. And that sober and scientific assessments of this crisis are converging in a consensus that our civilizational project is well down the road of what Derek Jensen calls an end game. Whether or not we feel it existentially. I like this sort of ironic statement of where we are in history, religion and science finally agreeing. Now, you're a proud literate in theology. You like to read theology. I really recommend this text that came out last year from another English theologian, Michael Northcott. It's called The Political Theology of Climate Change. Really important book, in my opinion. Points out some of the most salient and disturbing characteristics of what he calls the geopolitics of slow catastrophe. And I really like Leslie Stahl's comment in the film last night that the reason that the media isn't covering this is because it can't cover this because it's a slow incremental catastrophe. It doesn't have the mediagenic drama that entertains us on the 6 o'clock news. Northcott, these are just sort of some of his salient points. In the summer of 2012, a larger extent of the Arctic Ocean was open sea than at any time in the 200,000-year history of Homo sapiens. Far above predictions of even the most dire climate models. Some scientists predict the disappearance of summer ice altogether by 2035, something that hasn't happened in 2 million years. The pace of climate warming in the 20th century is unprecedented since the end of the last ice age. Methane and carbon release from a melting Arctic and subarctic region presage a catastrophic and far more sudden increase in global temperatures. Present rates of rising greenhouse gas emissions will see global temperatures rise by 4 to 7 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. A faster rate than ever before in planetary history. And here, friends, is the kicker. This is what the UK Meteorological Office published in 2009. It was a map of a 4 degrees Celsius warmer planet. And that map shows 3/4 of the Earth's land will be unsuitable for food growing and secure human settlement. 3/4. Northcott concludes on the current trajectory by the end of the present century, or within the lifetime of our grandchildren, the planet will be a new creation, but not of the making of God or evolution. We have to hit the venerable patch button. Somebody from upstairs keeps trying to send us a dispatch. The crucified earth, it's worth reflecting on. Now, the New Testament is unequivocal that the cross was not a natural disaster. However we might understand our atonement theologies, the Gospels are clear that Jesus' crucifixion was engineered by the logic of empire. It was the singular work of human hubris. Analogously, the scientific consensus today is that climate catastrophe is anthropogenic. This is what you keep trying to get your dad to understand. Indeed, our disastrous re-engineering of the planet has invoked a new definition of hubris. We now live in the age of the Anthropocene, a term coined in the 1980s by ecologist Eugene Sturmer and popularized by Nobel Prize-winning atmospheric chemist Paul Crutzen, which signifies the influence of human behavior on the Earth's atmosphere as being so significant as to constitute a new geological epoch. You can't see this very well, but this is about 25 iterations of that same curve of anthropogenic environmental change. Were we there when we crucified the earth? Can there be forgiveness if we know exactly what we are doing? These, dear friends, surely are the theological questions of our era. In the meantime, and it will soon get much, much meaner, especially for poor people, our ecological horizon darkens under cascading scientific assessments of our dwindling prospects, typified in secular books with religiously somber titles like God's Last Offer or The Bridge at the End of the World. Such relentless bad news, matched now every season by reports of extreme drought or flooding, rising seas, declining agriculture. All of this has generated a spectrum of cultural moods. On the depressive end, people swing from pessimistic brooding to slow-burn despair. On the manic end, from narcissistic resignation to business as usual, determined, increasingly desperate, technocratic optimism. Welcome to the bipolar apocalypse of the Anthropocene. You know, it's all snuck up on us. Just like the Apostle Paul said 2 millennia ago. For you know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. When they say peace and security, sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and there will be no escape. But we didn't see this coming. For the entire time we humans have dwelled on the planet, the big patterns of environmental change, no matter how dramatic, happened only incrementally, day by month, by year, by century, always giving us enough time to adjust. We could rely on the taproot grace of Creator to gift sun and rain on the just and unjust alike. Despite our occasional millennial fevers, there was always another day, a next generation. Always one more chance. But now all the evidence points to the prospect that the window of our way of life is closing, relentlessly pulled by machinery of our own making, with a momentum that is not likely to be reversed, even if we could muster the will to find the right levers to pull. We are truly, as Shakespeare's Hamlet famously put it, being hoisted on our own petard and taking the rest of creation down with us. So, what? Under the shadow of an earlier and equally foreboding apocalyptic moment, the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, if you're old enough to remember that, Thomas Merton offered an evangelical challenge. Christian hope, he wrote, begins where every other hope stands frozen stiff in the face of the unspeakable. Seems to me that this dictum haunts and resonates. Was Merton right? I think this utterly depends upon whether Christians today choose between discipleship or denial. Our faith and practice from now on will unfold either in light of or in spite of the ecological crisis. And while many of our co-religionists choose the latter path, it is up to us to explore the former path. Discipleship, not denial. I think I can say this at a gathering founded by Stanley Hauerwas. I hope it doesn't offend. I'm just playing the piano up here. In December 2012, a complex systems researcher named Brad Werner created a major buzz among the 24,000 Earth and space scientists at the fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco. Werner's session was titled, "Is Earth Fucked?" A title that I don't need to tell you is as startling at a scientific gathering as it would be at a theological one. The subtitle, in all fairness, as you can see, was "Dynamical Futility of Global Environmental Management and Possibilities for Sustainability." And this geophysicist from the University of California, San Diego, walked the crowd through an advanced computer model of system boundaries, perturbations, dissipation, attractors, bifurcations, and other stuff largely incomprehensible to those uninitiated in complex systems theory. But his bottom line was clear enough. Global capitalism has made the depletion of resources so rapid, convenient, and barrier-free that Earth-human systems are dangerously unstable. When pressed by a journalist for a clear answer on whether or not we are fucked, Werner set the jargon aside and replied, "More or less." There was one dynamic in his model, however, that offered some hope. Werner named this as resistance movements of people or groups who adopt a certain set of dynamics that do not fit within capitalist culture. And that's what I really want to talk about. Ironic that from such a surprising corner of the culture comes yet another evangelical invitation for the church to be church. Now, probably many of us in the room have had that terrible experience of getting the news of a terminal diagnosis of a loved one. And what is the commonsensical and pastoral thing to do in that moment? I think we would agree that the right thing to do upon the receipt of that bad news is to convene a family meeting to talk about now how do we live. I see this as that sort of family meeting. So I want to talk about how we live. I want to talk about transition. Transition movement, as most of you know, is scarcely a decade old, but growing, and it's trying to live into Werner's caveat, to be those groups of people living in resistance to the end game. It's a grassroots network of local communities working to build ecological resilience in response to peak oil, climate destruction, and economic instability. That's the official definition of the transition movement. I think it offers the most constructive public discourse in the face of these inconvenient truths today. The first theological book on transition has come out from our friend Tim Gorringe and Rosie Beckham in the UK. They see the transition approach as trying to steer between the apocalyptic social chaos scenario and the starry-eyed, high-tech versions of an energy-descending future. Again, that kind of bipolar roller coaster that we are on in the culture. And they argue that our churches need to learn from the transition movement and to understand that all of the major themes of the transition movement are already present in our Christian narrative. I agree. It is my conviction that in light of our anthropogenic endgame, every aspect of our faith and practice must be reevaluated in terms of a transition ethos, or in this fairly well-known graph by now, these are sort of the options facing us: techno-fantasy, green tech stability, that would be the Obama administration crash and despair. It is the notion of creative dissent or stewardship that seems to be the only path that is viable, and it is the path that our churches must embrace. Our urgent vocation as church is, as Dorothy Day famously put it, to build a new world in the shell of the old. So what are our chances? Over the last quarter century, there's been a proliferation of books and classes and conferences on eco-theology popularized through creation care and earth spirituality movements. They've gained wide traction in our churches. We wouldn't be having this conversation if not for all of that. It could be argued that environmental stewardship is the fastest growing area of public concern in our churches today. Initially among mainstream Catholics and Protestants, now increasingly among evangelicals and Anabaptists. This creation care trend has been necessary to help us recalibrate our theology, but it is far from sufficient to the creation crisis we now face everywhere. On one hand, our environmental theologies are still overly abstract and insufficiently contextual. On the other hand, the practical translations of creation care are too often merely cosmetic. Congregations going green by recycling and light bulb changes while avoiding political controversies such as tar sands extraction. We need to shape approaches that are more radical, diagnosing the root pathologies within us and around us, and drawing deeply on the roots of our faith tradition, so more radical and at the same time more practical. Now, just a word, kind of continuing Norm's talk from yesterday. There are several fatal core paradigms that have given rise to the Anthropocene apocalypse. Philosophical errors embraced by Western Christianity by and large that have underwritten histories of destruction and domination for the last half millennium. I just want to name three. One is the functional docetism that has numbed us Christians to the escalating horrors of both social and ecological violence, in which spiritual or doctrinal matters forever are trumping terrestrial or somatic ones, allowing us to pillage creation because it is assumed that salvation occurs outside of it or beyond it. Docetism has engendered a culture of displaced and displacing mobility, severing us from rootedness in particular places while facilitating the conquest and colonization of the homelands and habitats of others. Whole world of hurt in that mistake. A second error would be the anthropological presumption that humans rule over creation. An assumption, interestingly, shared with equal ferocity by religious traditionalists and secular modernists. It rationalizes how modern technological development exploits and re-engineers nature to benefit human settlement alone, or increasingly these days, only the elites. Androcentrism has allowed the earth and her life forms to be turned by humans into commodities to be extracted, owned, traded, consumed, and disposed of. And thirdly, the theology and politics of divinely ordained entitlement to land and to resources, both in the colonizing sense and in the extractive sense, which categorically rejects any suggestion that our production and consumption should be proscribed, and relieves us of any responsibility for the restoration of degraded land and biotic and human communities. Entitlement has justified our bankrupting of the Earth's natural fertility and the privatization of her commonwealth. These three articles of modern faith, largely shared, by the way, by theological conservatives, all share a fantasy of human autonomy despite protests to the contrary, which refuses the fundamental imperative of creatureliness to live within the limits of the earth. If we survive this thing, friends, I believe that we will look back upon the era of modernity as a legacy of madness paralleling the era of the Crusades. Or as Vonnegut again put it rather wryly, "Dear future generations, please accept our apologies. We were roaring drunk on patrol." Now, to combat these pathologies, Christians must develop and embody an ethos that is robustly incarnational rather than docetic. And, Norm got into this a little bit yesterday where he was talking about incarnational not as yet another abstract theological doctrine. It's amazing how abstract theologians can be about incarnation. But rather the recovery of the somatic and the sensate. Notice Norm yesterday named the five senses. That is actually how we were created to encounter creation, is through our senses, not through our ergo cogito sum. Cogito ergo sum. Whatever. So we have to be incarnational rather than docetic. We have to be symbiotic rather than Promethean. And we have to be sustainable rather than selfish. If the roots of this historic endgame lie in our alienation from the earth, then it is surely to the earth we must return, to paraphrase the warning in Genesis 3:19. But not in theory, or rhetorically, or as a romantic ideal. Rather, discipleship needs to be restored to the center of our Christian theology and transition practices to the center of our discipleship. In the face of abstract evil, our ecclesiology must be unashamedly contextual. In the face of cynicism and resignation, confessional faith must be fiercely constructive. And in the face of overwhelmed paralysis, our eschatological hope must be unequivocally practical, contextual, constructive, and practical. All of this begs the most fundamental issue. We cannot stand against what Walter Benjamin called the storm blowing from the future unless we stand somewhere. Which brings me to the second question raised by Vonnegut's Requiem. Are we human beings destroying the earth because we do not like it here? Is the real force animating our anthropogenic apostasy ultimately a profound lack of affection? Affection for and the resulting disconnection from God's creation? Now, pretty much everybody in this room knows that Kentucky farmer Wendell Berry has been the foremost critic of placelessness in North America and affection and advocate for a theology and practice of affection for actual land. On one hand, Berry laments the functionaries of globalized capitalism who roam freely. This prestigious class of rampaging professionals, he says, must have no local allegiances, no local point of view. In order to be able to desecrate, endanger, or destroy a place, after all, one must be able to leave it and to forget it. One must never think of it as one's home. One must never think of it as someone else's home. On the other hand, Barry invites and challenges us to stand somewhere. In a controversial 1989 essay titled The Futility of Global Thinking, you might remember 1989 was the apex of global thinking. Wendell Berry wrote, "No place on earth can be completely healthy until all places are." Well, that, of course, is just reiterating Dr. King's magnificent assertion that injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. We're all tied in a single garment of destiny. But then Barry goes on to say, the question we must address is not how to care for the planet, but how to care for each of the planet's millions of human and natural neighborhoods, each of its small pieces and parcels of land, each of which is in some way precious and different. When I encountered these texts in the early 1990s, they spoke to my condition, as Quakers say. The first Gulf War had left me enraged as a citizen of empire. Los Angeles had just burned for the second time in my life because of endemic social disparity. And my father had died suddenly, my last link to five generations of family roots in California. I was experiencing symptoms of a depressive condition that I only later learned was what eco-psychologists now call solastalgia, the condition of being homesick in a home place that is being destroyed. Throughout my life, I'd seen the fragile chaparral and oak savanna landscapes of Southern California relentlessly bulldozed and paved over by all manner of manic and unregulated development. Suburban tracts and trophy homes, resorts and boutique wineries, golf courses and shopping malls, military complexes and industrial agriculture, all animated by transplanted opportunists pursuing a fantasy life and corporate exploiters seeking quick profit. So nostalgic. And now we all get to feel so nostalgic for the planet as a whole. And I just can't help it. Last night during the film, grief just kept welling up in me as I watched those ice sheets collapse. I have no soul connection to the Arctic, but I have a soul connection to a place, and deep calls to deep, and grief calls to grief. A fierce desire arose in me 20 years ago to defend what little was left of our native landscapes that had so profoundly imprinted upon my soul growing up. My organizing work with indigenous people through the 1980s had impressed upon me that traditional people struggle long and hard against incredible odds, not because they hate the oppressor, but because they love the place they're struggling for. So I determined to reconnect with the place that I was living on, but not into, as Gary Snyder likes to put it. So I began the journey of replacement, a journey that has been both outward, political, social, ecological, and inward, psychic, spiritual, and theological. The apocalypse of the Anthropocene presents us with a myriad of technological, economic, and political challenges that the church must take seriously. But I believe, friends, that the personal and political disciplines of replacing ourselves are absolutely key for Christian identity reformation and for the church's gospel witness. Only a grounded incarnational faith can do battle with the placeless docetism of modernity. Only relationship with proximate, meaning right there, biotic communities, can wean us off our presumptive superiority. And only the long-term project of living sustainably somewhere can wean us off the addictive compulsive consumption and quest for autonomous infinitude that constitutes our entitlement. We human beings have lost our way as creatures of God's biosphere, and only the map woven into creation can lead us home. For more than 40 years now, an old, new paradigm, broadly termed bioregionalism, has been re-emerging in North America and beyond. With its spiritual roots in traditional indigenous cultures, it represents a body of thought and related practice that has evolved in response to the challenges that we're talking about. Kirkpatrick Sales' 1985 primer provides a helpful definition of bioregionalism. Bios is from the Greek word for forms of life, and region is from the Latin regere, territory to be ruled. They convey together a life territory, a place defined by its life forms, its topography, and its biota, rather than by human dictates. We might say a region governed by nature, not legislature. And if the concept initially strikes us as strange, that may perhaps only be a measure of how distant we have become from the wisdom it conveys. More recently, bioregionalists, myself included, have emphasized an even more specific locus for re-inhabitory literacy and engagement, focusing on what is most basic to life, namely water. John Wesley Powell was the first non-native person to raft successfully down the Colorado River in the 1860s. He was a one-armed Civil War veteran. And he gave us our first modern definition of a watershed. It is that area of land, a bounded hydrologic system, within which all living things are inextricably linked by their common water course, and where, as humans settled, simple logic demanded that they become part of the community. It's a really good definition. It's still used on the USGS website. The fact is, wherever each of us resides, city, suburb, rural area, our lives are deeply intertwined within such a bounded hydrologic system. Precipitation hits the ridges and either flows into our watershed or into a neighboring one, drained by a water course and its tributaries, even if they're buried under concrete. The area covered in the water's journey from its origination in the hydrologic cycle to its end point in a particular body of water, a pond, a lake, the ocean, is the watershed. Each watershed consists of a unique mix of habitats that influence each other. Forests, wetlands, fields, meadows, rivers, beaches, towns, brownfields, toxic waste dumps. All life is watershed place. No exception. And our ignorance about this fact is consequential. So, anybody want to have a guess where we stand today? What watershed we're in? Right here in Chicago.
Well, it flows into the Great Lakes on that side of some kind of water.
We know it flows into the lake. Right. We are in the Chicago Calumet watershed. Pictured here. That's our watershed. Not a great image, but that's the best one I could find. Now, Rob Goleman, a permaculturist and founder of Occidental Art and Ecology Center in Northern California, argues that watersheds underlie all human endeavor and form the foundation for all future aspirations and survival. And he cuts his hands, invoking the metaphor of a cradle. He calls this our basin of relations. Every organism is interconnected and dependent on the health of the whole. This is a social, local, intentional community with other life forms and inanimate processes like fire and water cycles. And it is the geographic scale of applied sustainability. And we must regenerate our watersheds if we are to survive. Now, obviously, promoting this alternative way of viewing reality is a challenge. Watershed mapping is a practical tool for advancing our literacy in the actual landscapes that sustain us, because it requires us to learn about the geological features, soil types, climate zones, flora and fauna, as well as about built environments. At the same time, it helps us reimagine the world. And that's where we come to your handouts and also put the image up. In Western culture, our social and ecological worldviews have been profoundly shaped by two-dimensional political maps. But these are social reproductions that enshrine problematic historic legacies of colonization and exploitation while rendering nature secondary or invisible altogether. So you know this image, it's burned into our consciousness from the earliest of ages. Now consider this alternative map of the U.S. imagined by John Leahy. It's also on your handout. How might our political culture change if the basic unit of governance was nature rather than legislation? There's a very interesting story we don't have time to go into of John Wesley Powell advocating for a watershed map of the Western states in the Erie territories, a battle he lost in Congress in the 1890s thanks to the railroad. Although bioregional thought and practice has spread widely and matured deeply over the last quarter century, it has been mostly ignored by Christian theology and ethics until very recently. Here's another map. This is my county, Ventura County. And the lines of the county are overlaid on the four or five different watersheds. And you can see the sort of disconnect. Political boundaries are often straight. No continental U.S. state is without a straight line. While watershed ones never are. Straight lines are the first order of abstraction, alienating us from the topographical and hydrological realities that sustain us. Or as Harvard Talmadge's scholar John Levinson puts it, geography is simply a visible form of theology. That'll preach. Or not. It's a really interesting exercise. It struck me on one of my many plane trips from west to east. You know, you fly over the Colorado Plateau, and this is often what you see from the air. This is an aerial view of the Santa Fe Desert. And the only thing visible to the naked eye is what? It's the way the water flows. That is the keystone characteristic of the design of creation. Unreengineered. Now here's another aerial view. You're going to have to get rid of the thing there. Thank you. Here's another aerial view of our beloved city of Las Vegas. And of course, the only thing we can see here is the way the traffic flows. It's almost impossible to see the way the water flows. What would it mean for Christians to recenter our citizen identity in the topography of creation rather than in the political geography of dominant cultural ideation, and in turn to ground our discipleship practices in the watersheds in which we reside? I am convinced that a watershed paradigm holds not only a key to our survival as a species, but that it can also inspire the next great renewal of a church determined to live in light of, not in spite of, the looming ecological endgame. It roots creation care in place, offering a radical and yet practical approach to transition faith. So some of us are experimenting with a way of framing these matters and trying to get to the question, how do we talk about this? It's an alliance of faith-rooted organizers and educators around North America, and we're currently exploring the idea of watershed discipleship. And it seems to be resonating. The phrase is a triple entendre. On one hand, it recognizes that we are in a watershed historic moment of crisis that demands that environmental and social justice and sustainability be integral to everything we do as Christians and as citizen inhabitants of specific places. On the other hand, it acknowledges the inescapably bioregional locus of an incarnational following of Jesus. You follow Jesus somewhere. And we no longer have the luxury to imagine that we don't. Our discipleship in the life of the local church takes place in a watershed context, and we have to reconnect the life of the church to that context. And on the third hand, and perhaps most importantly for folk like us, it implies that we need to be disciples of our watershed. I, in the lectio this morning, talked a lot about the image from Job inviting us to learn from the rabbi of the earth, to apprentice ourselves to creation. In the New Testament, discipleship is a journey of learning from, following, and coming to trust the rabbi. And our rabbi, hand in hand with the cosmic Christ that Norman talked about yesterday, is our watershed. The challenge here, to paraphrase an immensely important argument made by Senegalese environmentalist Baba Douyum back in 1968, is simply this, friends. We won't save places we don't love. And we can't love places that we don't know. And we don't know places that we haven't learned. From the beginning of human history, nothing was more crucial to the survival and flourishing of human societies than a symbiotic, relational ethos of watershed literacy and loyalty. And so, the time has come for us to return to the teachings, to return to the first wisdom. Now, it's important to head off a possible misunderstanding at this point. A watershed focus does not mean that we can escape from all the wider myriad issues of society or politics, as has quite frankly too often been the case with middle-class white conservationist agendas. Oh, great. Now we can talk about watersheds. We don't have to talk about racism anymore. I came to bioregionalism steeped in peace and justice activism for 40 years. I'm deeply committed to an integral approach. After all, virtually every watershed on the planet, now including Greenland, bears scars of disparity and exclusion and violence, both historic and contemporary. And all these things can and should be mapped and engaged at a watershed level. 2 days ago, three very dear friends of mine, two of them pastors, were arrested in Detroit for preventing water from being shut off to poor people. We are now experiencing water apartheid in our inner cities. That's a watershed issue. It's also a justice issue. It's also an issue of race and class and social architecture. 2.5 weeks ago, I had the distinction of being the 1,001st person arrested in the Moral Monday movement at the capital of Raleigh, North Carolina, one of the most important social movements happening right now, being led by the African American church, around social issues of voting rights and welfare rights. But Moral Monday understands that the retrograde legislation happening in North Carolina, it's all of a piece. The North Carolina legislature is directly taking money from healthcare, education, and welfare and handing it to the carbon industry by subsidizing fracking. Fusion politics, they call it in North Carolina. It's all of a piece. And every part of that fabric is resident in the watershed where you live. That said, all you Hanawassian Neo-Anabaptists might delight in the fact that watershed discipleship embraces the old Anabaptist conviction that because the God of the Bible cannot be identified with the state, citizenship should be understood as loyalty to God's good creation, which trumps all human ideological and hegemonic claims. Does this not represent, friends, the final deconstruction of Constantinianism? in favor of bioregional identity and affection. Obviously, understanding Christian discipleship in terms of a commitment to heal our world by restoring the social and ecological health of our respective watersheds is a perspective still marginal in our churches. Yet, ecclesial communities of place can make an enormous contribution to the wider historic struggle to reverse our ecological catastrophe. And in the process, we just might recover the soul of our faith tradition. We Christians are deeply culpable in the present crisis, but we also have ancient resources for the deep shifts needed. So I want to invite us in our table talk to reflect on what are the marks of a watershed ecclesiology. What are the marks of a watershed ecclesiology? How do we do theology in a watershed? How do we read scripture from a watershed point of view? How can our liturgy and our spirituality be impacted? And how does every single practice of our churches change when we are in fundamental conversation with not the earth in abstract, but with the watershed in which we actually reside? It is as concrete and perhaps trivial as what kind of flowers the altar guild puts on the altar. Why not native flowers? Why not a relentless commitment to native flowers? Because when those dry, not so interesting flowers are on the altar, it provokes a conversation. Why? Native habitat, as opposed to exotic English roses. Two, as profound as what kind of water do we use in baptism? Better go out to the river.
I went down to the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, oh Lord, show us the way.
But if you can't go out to the river or lake or pond, at least get that water and bring it in. And if it's polluted, well, that's an important talking point too now, isn't it? Everything about who we are as church, as liturgy. I want to give a shout out to my good friend Sarah. Stand up, Sarah Nolan here, my compañera from the Ventura County Watersheds. She's working on a program, Episcopalians do this sort of thing, called Localize the Liturgy. You're going to hear more about the Abundant Table Farm Project in one of the films tonight. Great demonstration project. Localize the Liturgy. They're trying to get congregation to ask, where in fact does our bread come from? Or our wine? Or the fabrics on the altar? It engenders a conversation about local economy and about sustainability and about what is exotic and what is indigenous. These are the kind of conversations not only that we should be having in church, but that maybe church is one of the last safe places to have these kinds of conversations about savvy economics, about local strategies of resilience. So what I want to invite you to do is in your table talk, before we get there, we're not quite there yet, right? In your table talk, I want you to go around the table and I want you to introduce yourselves to each other with this self-introduction. I'm Chet Meyer, and I'm a disciple in the Ventura River watershed. If you know your watershed. If you don't know your watershed, then just introduce yourself as I'm Chet Meyer. I'm a disciple in a watershed whose name I will shortly find out. And it's okay not to know. We have to start where we are. And then I want you to talk about two ways in which your liturgy, your church practices, how you use the church kitchen, as Zoran was talking about yesterday, how you redeploy the church lawn, how you repurpose the church parking lot. Couple of ways in which you think your own church might become a demonstration project. If the church is to have an evangelical future, I believe it will be through showing the good news in the midst of the Anthropocene apocalypse. And that means we have to be demonstration project.
Well, Clarence Durden said that a long time ago, didn't he?
We have to be demonstration project. Now of transition faith. I began by citing 1 Thessalonians. And I want to just note that all of these ecclesial practices that you will brainstorm, they don't actually require your parishioners to buy in to a dire analysis of climate catastrophe. They actually make perfectly good common sense all on their own. But pursuing them can and should open up a deeper conversation and consciousness, because we are at a watershed moment. This catastrophe has come upon us like a thief in the night. Now, Paul was probably citing Jesus of Nazareth, who said something about binding a strong man and ransacking his house. And who said more than once that unless we turn our history around, we are well and truly fucked. But from that same passage, Paul goes on to assert that you, beloved, are not in darkness, for that day to surprise you like a thief. You are children of light. So then let us not fall asleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober. This old apostolic exhortation returns us to Merton's dictum about Christian hope in the face of the unspeakable, the truth of which will rise or fall on our choice between ecocidal denial or watershed discipleship. I believe that Paul and Jesus are still calling Christians to live fully awake to the realities of the coming storm that modernity has wrought, and to live in disciplined sobriety from the addictive, compulsive life ways that are killing everything, and to recover urgently the old ways and wisdom. But imperatives, and I'm well aware that this talk has been full of imperatives, rarely animate radical change. The truth is, we will embrace this watershed vocation only if and when we decide that, contrary to Vonnegut's Requiem, we do like it here. We do like it here. Only by rediscovering that great affection will we devote ourselves, our whole selves, to repair the ancient covenant of the people of God, which still enjoins us to learn in order to know, in order to love, in order to save the specific terrestrial homes in which Creator has placed each and every one of us. So I invite you to begin your talk by introducing yourself as I suggested, and then do some brainstorming on one or two ways that your parish, your church, your congregation, your local community group can concretely embody a watershed discipleship. Practices, symbolism, disciplines. All right, let's go at it for 15 minutes or so.